History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And if we're willing to take a little time to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors and to listen patiently for what comes back our way, those stories don't have to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that endeavor, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's not too often that something that was lost more than 75 years ago is reunited with its owner, but that's what happened when the cup from an ex-prisoner of war's mess kit made it back to him. When I heard about that, I had to get in touch with Harold Radish, who was gracious enough to spend this hour with us from his home in New York City. Before we talk about this latest twist in 2021, let's talk about your childhood in the Big Apple.
I'm an immigrant son. My parents came from Poland. They came a lot before the Second World War. They weren't involved in the prisons and stuff like that. They came because they were pretty poor. From what my mother used to tell me about when they were kids cleaning up for the kitchen, it was a sand floor. So, you know, it was Poland, and at that time it was a sort of a part of Russia. And the problem with the boys was that the Cossacks would come around and pull them, draft them into the army. So they would try to get to the States as quick as they could. They didn't know each other when they were growing up. They came here separately, and eventually they met here. How did they meet? On the Lower East Side in Manhattan, where all the Jews lived that came from Europe, there were movies. And it was a time where a movie was two people for 5 cents. So you had to find the one that had that odd penny. And my father apparently had an extra penny. So they got together, and from then on, eventually, you know, they got married.
So you're here because of a lucky penny? Is that what you're telling me?
That's what it is. That's what it is. And they moved from the East Side. My father was a plumber, but he had a problem. He could do jobs and stuff. He knew his business, but he didn't know the English language that well, so he couldn't pass any of the licensing exams. So that was a little hard for him, but he made a living. They moved to Brooklyn, Brownsville, which was a step up at the time for them. The family moved. It ended up with my mother and father, her mother and father, my father's mother and father, and an uncle. They bought a house, which was a six-family house, and they all chipped in so that they could have three apartments on one side of the house, and the other side was the rental, so that they could sort of carry the house while they worked. They were fairly poor, from what I can understand, from what I had heard. And they took care of me. I grew up fairly well. I didn't know what poverty was or anything, but went to junior high school and high school, and I ended up taking industrial arts. I became a shop teacher. I went from high school to NYU, and I was lucky. I got a scholarship to NYU. I was at NYU, I guess, about 6 months when I got drafted.
Do you remember as a boy having some ideas of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
I had some idea. Most of what I got into was because of my parents, especially my father. In those days, they were insecure in their work. So the big thing was civil service. They told us constantly, you study, you work, you'll take an exam, you'll become a school teacher, you'll work for the city, you'll get paid. You'll get vacation, and you'll even get paid for your vacation. That was the big thing, because when they were off, they didn't get paid. I remember there was an uncle. He must have been about 40 years old. He became a civil servant. He was the first one in the family, and he worked for the Department of Sanitation, just shoveling the offal into a can. In those days, they were horses, and they made such a party for him, like he became president of the United States. This is the first guy in our family that got into civil service. He was recognized, you know, he was an American, so to speak.
You know, something else that I'm curious about, and I don't know if this will trigger anything or not, but many of the Jewish American veterans I've talked to had a feeling about the war long before America was in the war, because they would read the newspapers and they'd hear things, and some even had family members who were still in Europe and were becoming either displaced or taken captive because of the Holocaust.
The ghettos and the Holocaust. You know, fortunately, I don't remember anybody in my family being in the Holocaust involved in that. But we did see the movies and stuff, and we were very, very upset when there was Hitler and Mussolini, Il Duce, you know, and we'd see the movies, the Fox Movie Tone News, you know, battles and taking over of the Reichstag, the fire, you know, and things of that sort. That I remember. And, you know, when I grew up in the family enclave, the six family house where everybody spoke Yiddish. I knew English from being out on the street, but my Yiddish was very good. And that got me into trouble in the prison camp. You know, I used to think that Yiddish was close to German, and it was. Occasionally, I would interpret for some of the guys with the guards. The guards in the prison camp wouldn't recognize that I was talking Yiddish or asking them questions in Yiddish because they weren't that educated. They thought my German was from the country somewhere, you know. But we went from one prison camp to another prison camp. And before you went into that other prison camp, you were searched in a way. So what you did was they lined you up, and you, before you got in, you had a blanket. Everybody had a blanket, whether it had holes in it, you know, it was wintertime, holes or torn, but you had a blanket. And you spread that blanket out, and whatever you had in your pockets, you put on top of the blanket. Whatever you didn't want them to see, you dug a little hole under the blanket, and you put it in there. We were sitting there, and it was, I don't know, it took quite a while. But then the guy in a white shirt, which apparently was an SS guy, came by. And foolishly, I said to him, "Wie lang? How long?" And he looked at me. And he, in German, he said, "Jude, you Jew, Wall Street, you started the war, verfluchter Mensch." I still don't know what that means, but I remember these words. And I must have gotten ashen. I was ready to pass out. He did have a little baton, and he rapped me on a knuckle or something. But somebody called him, and luckily he walked away. And then the guys got around me and said, "What happened? What happened?" I said, "Forget about it." And that was it. Never said another word of Yiddish again.
Wow. Boy, that's alarming. I can't imagine how that must have felt.
Oh, boy. It took a while to get over it. You know, I'd been shot at. I had shrapnel drop on my head and all the rest of that. But that didn't scare me as much as when this guy started to yell about Wall Street and so. I thought I was finished at that point.
Well, I believe it. I'd like to hear a little bit, too, of what led up to that. And it seems like all the World War II veterans I've had the privilege of talking to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember hearing about the attack on Pearl Harbor and really America's entrance into the war?
Yeah, I was in high school at the time. And I do remember there was a Sunday, I think it was a football game or something, and then the Pearl Harbor came on. And where was Pearl Harbor? Who had any idea of what it was? You know, we had studied geography in elementary school and all. And then when we got to school that Monday, there was the speech that the president made. I remember Pearl Harbor, but it didn't hit. You know what I mean? I was a youngster. It didn't mean, it was like the news, you know, it happened. And that was, and I still remember the movie tone, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that kind of thing that we saw in the movies all the time. It was always there. Movies was a big thing with us, I think. We always went once or twice a week to the movies.
Well, you know, that makes me wonder, too, as I talk about Pearl Harbor and folks who were there on Oahu had the fear that the Japanese are coming back. People on the West Coast here were afraid of the Japanese shelling the coast or bombing. And where you were on the East Coast in New York City, I've heard stories about, you know, the U-boat threat, that was a real palpable fear of U-boats off the coast. Did you ever catch wind of much of that?
Yes. Yeah. There was U-boats. One of them, I think, got to Staten Island. But I don't know, maybe I wasn't that sharp at the time, but it didn't really hit. Yeah, it was news. I heard it, and that was it. It just, there was no real fear yet. I had no fear, you know, even when I got into the service, there was no fear, you know. Maybe I have a certain intelligence up to a certain level.
Well, when did it become real for you? When did you realize, hey, I'm going to have to be a part of this nationwide effort?
Well, when I got overseas, it started after Mets. I was a replacement. I was part of the repo depot business, and I sailed over on the Queen Elizabeth. So there wasn't that problem with 10 days or 14 days. It was 6 days, and we were going pretty fast. And they got in with the 90th Division, the 357th Regiment, and I was a recon sergeant. I was trained in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. That's another lifetime. Going from New York to Hattiesburg, seeing this mass of all these people, and sometimes getting out into the town and seeing the signs, no color, you know, this. I didn't understand what was going on at the time. But while I was in training with the 69th Division, they started what they called cannon companies. They added a company to a division that would have the 105s. They started it, and then I took a test or something, and they made me a recon sergeant. So it was a good life in camp. I had a Jeep and all the rest of it. But when I got overseas, I was still a recon, but when I joined the company, you get into the company and everybody looks at you, you know, they don't trust you yet. They don't know who you are, what you are, and how you would work. But then when we started after Metz, we kept moving down France, got to Luxembourg, in that area, the forest, the Aachen forest. When the stuff started flying, then you knew you were a soldier. You would look across the line, and they would say fire, and you'd fire. I had to go out ahead of the group to get some information or whatever. You know, you were not frightened, but you did what you had to do. It hit me when the stuff started coming down. The Germans had shells that would hit the trees, and then they would explode and throw a lot of stuff at you. That's when things got a little heavy. I remember leading a company from one area when we had crossed the Saar River into Saarloch and Saarbrücken, and I remember bringing them as a recon. I supposedly knew where we were going, and that was tough. We had to do that at night. There was firing and all the rest. The guys that I were bringing were a new company, and I had to tell them how to get down and, you know, break up and not be close together. The threat was when the stuff got hot, when stuff started flying all around you.
How close did it come to you?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in a foxhole with three guys. This was before Bastogne. We couldn't move. The Germans were going on the way to Bastogne. We were on a little hill. They must have been down in a little valley. I could hear noise of marching constantly, day and night. And we were in this foxhole. We couldn't move. You raised your head up, something came flying. One day, some guy that was with me, we had a few logs on top of the foxhole. There were three of us in there, and it was big enough so that when some shell must have come by, a piece of the shell came through and hit him in the butt. Somehow it got through, and it was right next to me, and I said, "Ooh." But he started screaming, so we took a look. We cut off his pants and all, and it was just like a little scratch. And we said, "Look, if you ever get out of here, you got a $1 million wound. You'll be going home." So that's when it really got close. I was never really afraid. I don't know what it was. I was not comfortable, you know, so to speak. I can remember before we got into the prison camp, it was late at night. They wouldn't let us in because they couldn't check us. And this was February. I remember being on top of a bale of hay or something on the outside, freezing. That's the kind of thing that bothered me. I remember being in the cattle cars. You know, there must have been about, I don't know how many, at least 50 or 60 guys in there. Rushed together, and I remember being, in a way, not frightened, but trying to figure out what was going on. And then when our air corps came by and strafed us, then you got frightened again. You know, it was fear that came up when these instances started. Although they pulled the trains in under tunnels, so we were all right.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old ex-prisoner of war Harold Radish. We haven't heard about the circumstances of his capture yet. And there's a little twist to his story that did not arrive until more than 75 years after his liberation. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.